think about the others. Okay, I tried to get, I was thinking about getting 2 points across, which I'd like to tell the people what I'm currently interested in, but it will be major one, this one, and then very short, a completely different topic. So this is going to be about ionic liquids, and we try to study them across different scales. I'm on the top scale, basically, on this, in this case, atomistic part. My two colleagues here are Luigi Delisite, who will show up later, who is responsible for the key part, and then Robert Berger did the post-Hartree Fock ab initio calculations. So here you see pictures of all of them. Barbara Kirchner, also quantum chemist, did some help for us, and these are the two people here, the two students, Katharina Wendler and Florian Dommert, who did most of the work. What I try to start out with, because you're probably not familiar what ionic liquids are and why are they interesting. They don't belong really traditionally to the soft matter area, although they definitely are complex, is a complex liquid, and therefore, coming back to the old term of soft matter, it's soft matter. So it's a complex liquid. Why is it complex? Well, it's basically a molten salt with a melting point below 373 K. So they can even be at room temperature liquid, and they are just in a liquid contained consisting of ions. They are a pretty big hype in the last, I don't know, 5 years, considered to be a green solvent because they have a vanishing vapor pressure. They are very potent, so you can dissolve lots of things without having this poisonous gases coming out, environmental friendly, non-flammable, and they are supposed to have tons of applications, and sometimes people call them also designer solvents, so you might make some catalysis in them and so on and so on. The design principle to produce an ionic liquid, one has many choices because they are basically bulky organic molecules, so bulky that the Coulomb interaction is rather delocalized, so that they don't form crystals at room temperatures but are already liquid. And so you can, people have come up in a synthesis where you have a variety of cation possibilities. I will show you that these imidazolium is a family of ionic liquids. They can vary the side chains, they can even go from a liquid phase to a liquid crystalline phase. You can vary the anions, and you can make mixtures, you can have chiral solvents, and so on. And normally one does an a posteriori measurement of the properties, and that is of course what the industry does not like. I mean, they would like to have some more predictive power. I mean, what are the melting points, what are the conductivities, diffusivities, and so on. And so there's a desire for a rational design. So what this means, we want to be able to predict at least some properties before synthesis, and for us that means, can one model ionic liquids on such a basis that we are a priori be able to tell or at least give guidelines of what properties you might expect if you synthesize a particular liquid. The investigated systems we are looking at are mainly these imidazolium based cations. So here you see this imidazolium, they have a normally a methyl side chain. On the other side, you can have side chains of different lengths. If it's another methyl group here, then it would be a dimethyl imidazolium. So that would be with n equals 1, and you can have any lengths basically here on the left side. The anions we look at are here the thiocyanate, chloride, and dicyanamide. Basically, I will stuck to the chloride.
But it's volatile. That's volatile, so then you have a finite vapor pressure.
No. With those you don't.
Then chloride?
Huh?
Isn't that volatile?
No.
That's
an
ion.
It's ion.
It's ion. So it's an ionic liquid, that's why they are not flammable. And we also looked at this protic, but I will tell you basically most of it about this dimethyl imidazolium chloride. So when we started, we said, okay, we would like to address this problem coming from different length scales, and the length scales basically should start with deep down quantum mechanical calculations on the post-Hartree Fock level, where you have accurate electronic structure, but the system sizes are just limited to very small and static systems. Then the idea was, I mean, now we do what we call a hierarchical or vertical multi-scaling, so you try to go up your scale. We're thinking of using DFT. This is what Luigi does and might tell you about this, where medium system sizes are possible. So you would be able to do an MD of a bulk liquid, but still computation is very demanding, and you always have problems, of course, that the density functionals which you use, that the exchange correlation effects are only approximate. So you have to make sure that you pick a good functional which is representative of this model. Then on the top, we wanted to come up with a force field by which you can then do classical atomistic MD, where the dynamics and statics of the macroscopic bulk system should be doable. You have fewer degrees of freedom. You cross-grained them already in a way away. And the problem is always that these force fields have to be parameterized, and you have to be sure that all relevant degrees of freedom are included. And so clearly what we wanted to try here is to gain some insights into this force field parameterization from the quantum mechanical side. So that was an issue we discussed yesterday. And on top of that, there is still the choice that you can, of course, go to coarse-grained MD and mean field approximations. So that is what we are actually doing currently for some systems, trying to see how far you can get there. And so far, we stuck to these three areas and tried to do some vertical multi-scaling here. What are the problems with the current classical force fields on these ionic liquids? The problem is that the way they were parameterized turned out that the dynamics of the liquids came out an order of magnitude too slow. So when you look at the fusion at conductivities, they simply didn't match. They were able to match the structure, so you parameterized them in the standard way, but the dynamics didn't work out. Dielectric properties are therefore also questionable. Transferability was not always given, so that from composition you had to reparameterize again. Problem with these ionic liquids is also that they have a slow dynamics. I mean, if you cool them down at some point, you will run into the glass transition, and then of course also atomistic MD is very time consuming, and you get stuck. One thing people worry is polarizability right now, and this is often not taken into account. I will come back to this point, and we will do a comparison of all what we have achieved so far to what's called the standard force field for an ionic liquid. This was derived a few years back from the Lopez group, and it will be abbreviated by the CLAP force field. So whenever I talk about CLAP, that is the old one which does not work so nicely on dynamics. So what people have been doing in order to speed up the dynamics of a force field was a so-called charge scaling approach. So the solution is, well, you have a force field. It contains a bunch of parameters. The mathematical functions which are in there are anyhow not accurate. I mean, there are some approximation to some underlying quantum mechanical theory. So there are parameters which you try to get a best match. And why not also use the charge of the ion is a free parameter in your force field. I mean, of course, you think it's an ionic liquid, so you have ions in the solution, they should have charges plus or minus one. But it could be, I mean, partial charges are also not maybe these realistic charges, so you can give them some other number. I mean, you can actually scale them down. And if you think about it, of course, if I have ions which have reduced charges, then they interact electrostatically less with each other, and that is less squeeze of energy. So the dynamics will be faster. That's what people did. That's called the global scaling of the ionic charges. Actually,
so Christian, do they still retain the correct structure then if they lower the charge, because they change the interactions, right?
You have to re-parameterize in order to do that. I mean, very subtle questions come of course up, because if you reduce something, you lose something, you have to put it in somewhere else, and you still retain the speed up. I will show you our way, and that is in a way a bit different. First one was actually Florian Müller-Plate, who used that laid back for polymer electrolytes. Then a few other people just did this by hand. I mean, there was not a good physical rationalized why to do it, except that it seems to give you better results, and therefore it's allowed. I mean, why not? Now, what we try to do is use the electron density of a bulk system. I mean, I won't talk very much about this Coase-Hartree-Fock stuff, because that we basically did in order to gauge the density functional series, say that this is an appropriate approach to study the quantum mechanical system. Then Luigi was running rather large CPMD simulations of this ionic liquid, and then we tried to use a consistent partial charge fitting to this bulk system in order to derive partial charges. Because what normally people do when they parameterize force fields is that you say, okay, I get these partial charges. You normally get them from quantum mechanical simulations, but you do that on isolated ions, actually. And so the big difference, what we did, is not take an isolated ion, but take a bulk system, because you have here a dense system of ions interacting with each other, and you say, if there are some polarization effects happening, then this will clearly be a better way of producing an electron density to which you can then map your partial charges. Now, the way it goes, I mean, I don't go into details, I mean, you generate snapshots with CPMD. You have basically 30 ions in per snapshot, so you have like 3,000 ion pairs, and to those you make, you get the electron density, and you assign partial charges to the atomic centers of your liquid, and you try to match the partial charges in such a way that it represents the electron, I mean the electrostatic potential net generated from this electron density to its best degree. And that is what we got out, that the charges actually, if you sum all the partial charges up of our ions, get reduced to a value of 0.63. And this is one number. What you see is that is a rather high fluctuation here, because depending on what kind of snapshot you do, you get a broader distribution of each partial charge. I mean, this is for comparison, of course, what this classical clap force field would give you. I mean, they are parameterized such that minus and plus one comes out neatly. And so you find actually from this ab initio simulation that there could be a reason why you want to use a force field with a reduced ionic charge parameterization.
Isn't that very much dependent on the mapping you're using?
No. I mean, we checked actually, I mean, there are different ways of getting partial charges.
Yeah.
CHELP, RES, BADA, Mulliken analysis, which is considered to be the worst of all. What we were using were a method due to Peter Blöchel, which is specifically designed for the reciprocal charge fitting. So you do multiple fit of all your charge. I mean, all the multiple moments get fitted correctly with smear gaussians around your atoms. It's just for CPMD, I mean, it's perfectly well suited. It's basically that thing which works easiest, and it has not the drawback of this, let's say, RES method, that you have to restrain the charge to certain values, because these other methods are basically much better if you have isolated systems, whereas the Blöchel one is actually the best one, which works for a bulk system. Now we said, is this maybe due to the system we were looking at? I mean, it was this DMIM chloride. Is this a particular strange system of an ionic liquid? Because technically it doesn't really belong to the class of an ionic liquid, because the melting point is at 130, 125 C. But we started out with that, I must say, because the Coase-Hartree-Fock guys were complaining, said, let's take the simplest one. It's also because other people have been working on this system a lot, so the knowledge on this system was the best, so that's why we started with this one. We did in the meantime also some other systems, like these EMIMs and this protic ionic liquid. What comes out if you do that is it doesn't really matter how much ion pairs you use for your bulk simulation. I mean, even if you take just 8, it shows the periodic boundary conditions. The numbers don't differ drastically. I would say they almost don't differ at all. I mean, it's surprising how close they come out. They are always in the range of 0.6, 0.7, when you look at the dipole moments of the system, for instance, you also see that, I mean, even the chloride, for instance, has a dipole moment, although you would think it is point charge, and it should be rather a spherical object. But due to the polarization effects, I mean, you have the chloride always sitting somewhere close to other charges, so the electron clouds get distorted, you develop actually instantaneous dipole moments, which, if you average them out, have this have this distribution here. So it's of course smaller than the imidazolium, but still considerable.
So do you have a rationale why the finite size effects are so small?
Well, what we say is that these charge correlations, I mean, you have a high dense liquid of ions, so I mean, actually you have a large effect of screening. That's the only thing we can come up right now, because if you think of this, I mean, Luigi did this analysis of dipole moment correlations. I mean, if you're above 5 angstrom away, then almost the dipole moments are not correlated anymore. 5 angstrom, that means you are within the first solvation shell, if you might call it, of your ionic liquid.
But and therefore, constant, of course, doesn't exist for a conductor, but on the time scale.
You can
so
define
the frequency
one.
Window you look at is only about 10, so because of that I would expect that there would be finite size effects.
I don't think the dielectric constant matters here, because that is the dielectric screening window. I mean, you're highly correlated in exuded volume effects here, because you're in the liquid size, and I mean, the electrostatic interactions actually seem to decay rather fast. I mean, if you consider just the bilengths here on the level of the bihuckel theory, I mean, it's in the angstrom range.
If you do the same thing, but let's say for an ionic crystal, sodium chloride, right? I mean, they can't be arranged in a better way to lower their electrostatic energy than that. And would that also give something? So if this averaging polarization releases charge, still, I mean, I have no
Yeah, that's a good question.
If you have electrons leaking over between.
Gives the charge lower than white.
It gets lower.
There's even people now simulating minerals with charges lower than the official charge line.
I mean, in the solid state business, people also do that, actually. I learned.
And it's because now we have sodium chloride, and of course, then the ions don't know that I think it should be plus one, minus one. They just figure out where they want to be, and then they find a compromise, and then the net charge is a fraction of it. That would be
the effective charge. If you iterate over all the vibrations, the effective charge is then
There are fixed charges and you neglect polarization. And because you neglect polarization, you can reduce the charge.
Let me take a sodium chloride crystal, and now I could calculate the total charge in a Voronoi cell centered on chloride and a Voronoi cell centered on sodium, and maybe I would not find plus minus one, but would that be the same thing?
Yeah, I guess so. Because in the Bader analysis, which you do, I mean, that's basically you define zero flux surfaces of the electrons. So that's basically what you do. I mean, it's a more sophisticated way than the Voronoi cell. And so also this topological kind of counting gives you a charge which is less than one. So you can, I mean, this is always, I mean, you can of course think that electrons just are on the other side, so to speak. I mean, they are free to go wherever they want. So you have, you can say you have some sort of charge transfer. I mean, electron charge goes from the goes to the more electronegative part reduces charge.
Okay. Have you applied this analysis to the positively charged ions as well? And do you get exactly the same numbers?
Yeah. I mean, this
I'm sure. Because the mapping is really non-trivial.
No, I mean, you do this actually to the complete neutral snapshot of the CPMD. I mean, you don't do it to a single ion, but you have the snapshot and you assign charges all over the place. And then you average over. And there's, of course, an averaging procedure. I mean, I can't tell you that. There's no way to pick actually an ion pair in the bulk. Who's the partner? So you do an average. And on the average, of course, because you start out with a charge neutral system, you end up with a plus minus 100% partitioning scheme.
Does it depend on temperature, pressure?
We have not done temperature pressure stuff. The more you ask, the less time you get.
That's fine.
No, the more time, I think that was the rationale.
I was going in the same direction, transferability issues. I suppose you will have some, but that's maybe
definitely
not temperature pressure, but I suppose in the end you want to simulate something bigger with the classical model, and that probably has inhomogeneities in there, or it has surfaces, interfaces, whatnot. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't make the classical model in the first place. As soon as you have that, will it break down? Because when you have a surface, you will not, this assumption that this works relies on isotropically averaging out the polarization.
I think if you have inhomogeneities, you will have to do more work. Because my suspicion is that then nothing goes around using really a polarizable force field for the atomistic sense. But right now we're just doing the bulk, actually sort of happy with what came out, because you have a rational, I mean, why you should start thinking in terms of these reduced charge force fields. You can compute them, and of course it's not a global charge scaling what you do here, because you have partial charges which are on sort of averaging, I mean, represent on the average the polarizability of these configurations. So, I mean, you have different partial charges than those you have, people have derived, for instance, the Clapp force field.
I'm just trying to understand what people mean, what you mean by a partial charge. So is it something like saying, well, if I look at the interaction between two ions, and I calculate the forces between them, and I look how that, what is the 1 over r part, then there's a prefactor which gives me my two charges. Is that what you're saying? So if I average over some fast time scales of fluctuation, and then I get some kind of interaction, some force between them, and I
mean, to what it comes down here is that you have access to the electron density, so you know where your electrons are.
Yes.
These electrons generate an electrostatic potential, which you can measure,
yeah.
I mean, which you
yeah.
can compute.
Yeah.
And now you try to make a system of fixed point charges, the so-called partial charges, which reproduce this potential map as accurately as possible according to your fitting procedure which you designed on the outset. I mean, he uses Bloch fitting, which is a bit different from
yeah.
what his Chalk or Resp is doing. But if you run them all through, I mean, they give you more or less all the same results.
Isn't that basically saying the same thing, or am I? Because you, what you do is you do this higher order calculation to get the effective charges. You calculate your potentials,
mm-hmm.
which basically give you how the way these things interact.
Yep.
And so what you're then putting in is effective charges that will give you the same interaction.
Yep, that's what I try to say.
Which is another way of, so maybe then it's not surprising at all that why should they be Q is equal to the bare charge, right? Because you have all this fluctuation stuff coming in, right? So if you were to take, if you were to hypothetically you were to take two of them and look at a large distance as they come towards each other, then you'd see a 1 over r interaction.
Yeah, let me put up this next
one
picture.
Potential, right?
Because
and
I mean,
the
way to understand it, I mean, it's
okay.
It goes on this electrostatic V field picture, I mean, very easy. I mean,
you should have just said, let me show you my next slide.
Yeah. Well, you can think of that this electron density, which is all over in the liquid, provides you with some sort of dielectric screening, and you can actually get a hint on what this dielectric screening should be, because it should be the infinite frequency dielectric constant, this optical frequency. That's related to what you can measure, actually. And if you go through these arguments, so you say you have a background of dielectric screening that reduces the bare charge towards some effective charge, then you have this relation between the optical constant here to the effective charge, and that fits very well actually with the measurements they have done on some ionic liquids. So it comes out to be 0.15, and that is actually 0.67 related to this 0.63 I was telling you, or I don't know if for EMIM it was a different factor, but it's right in the right part. But of course, it's a mean field picture saying that you reduce the charges homogeneously all over the place. So, I mean, there's no polarization way in there, there's just dielectric screening. But that makes you maybe a little bit, or remove some uneasiness in case you had one on the outset, why charge scaling might be a good way of proceeding.
You might turn around and say, of course you should charge scale, right?
Of course, yes. Actually, there are people, I just met this guy, and we were thinking about this, and then it turned out some referees said, well, you should look at these people from Brukhof, you know, some Russians here in the US, also in California. They have been saying this actually for force field characterizations of apolar substances, that you also should take care of these effects. And so this is some ideas which have been around in some other area, but here in the ionic liquids it seems to be particularly important, or at least in my point of view, it seems to be a key fact which helps you to produce a better force field. But now you're not done yet, because you just have the partial charges, and the force field consists of many more parameters. So what we are doing now is trying to incorporate that into the standard club force fields, because the different partial charges first will invalidate your force field. If you stick to club, because it yields wrong densities, dihedral angles, so what Art said, the structure is now completely wrong. So you have to correct by that. So you do the same things what other people do. You correct that, you get the correct dihedral angles. Then what we are using now is, because we have this ab initio part, we have also not only densities there, but we also have partial GeoVars. We know how the partial structure factors look like, at least in the DFT, if you believe that those are the right ones. And you can use them actually as input for your force field parameterization. And we also use some temperature ranges, so that was my student did quite a lot of work on making this somehow automatic fitting parameters, because again, you have many parameters. It's not a nicely posed problem to produce a set of parameters which gives you good things in a wide range. And I just want to show you the first results we have for this denim chloride thing. So that's how these partial structure factors look like. The G of R here for the H1 chloride, H3 chloride, the black ones are the clap, and you can make them better by appropriately fitting. I don't want to go into the details. Interesting is, does it lead to anything? Density, of course, is fitted in, so that is not an outcome. The outcome is really the dynamics, because we do not do any fit for any of these dynamical properties. The only thing we fit it to is the density of some range of temperature and the G of R's. And so the rest, this is really what comes out. This is the diffusion. I can just tell you the diffusion is faster by an order of magnitude than the clap diffusion. Unfortunately for this stupid system, there are no experiments available. Fortunately, there is conductivities available. I have no clue why they can't measure diffusivities if they have conductivities, but it's just what the literature tells you. And this is basically what we get out here. The red line is what our force field brings over a range of temperature. This is what the measurement does. So it looks actually quite nice, and it's at least an order of magnitude better than the clap one.
So do you have connectivity just by transport of molecules, or can you have charge transport between molecules as well?
This is transport of molecules. So
this is in a macroscopic externally applied field.
Then it would be the same. Then the diffusivity would directly give you the connectivity. That's why I was asking.
Yeah. The diffusivity does not give you the connectivity.
If you have only transport via motion of molecules and not charge from molecule to molecule, then that should give you the connectivity. Should be able to calculate from that.
Not from the diffusivity, no. This is, unless you believe in Nernst Einstein, which says that diffusivity is basically 1 over d plus plus 1 over d minus, which neglects correlations. You can have correlations, because just think about it, you have a high affinity for packing a plus and a minus that makes a neutral molecule that doesn't transport anything. So you have correlations in the system. And actually, that's why we plotted these two things. EH stands for Einstein-Helfer. This is the complete Green-Kubo relation, including all correlational effects, and the Nernst-Einstein is the one which you just get from diffusivity. This is what is actually plotted here. And then you see that there are correlations which, factor 2 or 3, we computed this ratio at some point, and that's actually what people measure also in ionic liquids, because they can measure separately the diffusivities and the conductivities, and that fits quite nice. There are some.
So what you're saying is that you're half hours and you're over. What you're saying is that there are correlations, like cages, which live for a long time.
Not cages. I mean, just think about
clusters, which is essentially the same. Which live for a long time and destroy this picture that you can directly from the facility.
Yeah, but this is all well known. I mean, this is.
Yeah. But if this exists, I understand that. That's clear. But how does this then relate to your picture that you had before, that electrostatics is strongly screened off? You only have to look at the immediate environment of a molecule, you say that in bilength, if you calculate something like a bilength, which is questionable, the context is in the Angstrom range, somehow I have difficulties to get these different pictures together.
Yep. I mean, it still means that even on the bilengths, you can, of course, have clustering, because plus and minus, I mean, the strength of that interaction determines basically what the correlation is, I would argue.
I mean, the stronger they are correlated,
the less. I don't think it's a contradiction. The more they stick together, the stronger the correlation has, the longer, I mean, the more questionable this bi-length picture gets, because the more you make clusters, you reduce the amount of free isotopes. But I wouldn't argue this way. You just see correlations, it is better. End of story. This is already my conclusion. I still have some more time, because Marcus. So what we did.
If you do that, then we will have lunch at
30.
I'm fine with
that.
I'm not.
You're starving.
Yeah, you're the one who can change it, actually. You know.
Can we do yours also?
So this is our current status. I think it is quite nice. You can use some quantum mechanical information to get some idea on this charge scaling. You still have to do a lot of parameterization of the force field, and of course things can go wrong there. We got conductivities out, dynamical information which we did not put in to the force field, because we only parameterized towards structure and got out better dynamics. So I think that is the most strong point right now. This charge scaling seems to be a universal feature in these ionic liquids. We are right now working on parameterizing some more interesting structures in order to be reasonably sure that this also works for first more interesting substances, also substances which have more experimental data available, so we can directly look at diffusivity, conductivity, viscosity, and so on. There's still the question of transferability we are working on right now.
So this just to chip in with a question concerning the transferability.
Sorry. Yep.
When you calculate conductivities, do you actually apply an electric field?
Nope.
If you were, if you were to apply an electric field, wouldn't then the whole model probably break down, because you have a net polarization of your system and the entire parameterization? I mean, the parameterization has been, again, under the assumption of isotropically averaging polarization effect, and now you apply a field and you have net polarization, and probably your partial charges will not be valid anymore.
Well, I believe in the linear response regime, it really doesn't matter. I mean, if you bang on the system hard enough, you see non-linear responses, and then probably breaks down, but I believe in...
The point is rather, would you measure in a macroscopic field, would you measure a charge of 1 or 0.6?
Yeah,
That is something we have been banging our heads actually quite a lot. The current status is in the Wien-Kubo relation, you use the reduced charges. I can tell you later on why you think that is correct, but it's not obvious. Put it this way. Okay, transferability, I think we can discuss the rest in private. I just want to have a few slides. I really don't tell you anything. No, I just was talking for 35 minutes.
You are talking now for 35 minutes already.
Yes, he was 45.
Yeah, that was too long anyhow. So that was the point that none of us
let's not discuss, because I really, it's less than 5 minutes. I just want to say I'm interested also in other problems.
He said at the end as well.
I mean, maybe we can just vote. I mean, maybe I give my presentation at another time and slash place.
No, we should do this now, because otherwise...
It really passed. I don't want to go into any details. I was going to say I have another point problem which I like right now. It's completely different nature. It's about understanding electric currents in DNA translocation experiments. So you have a nanopore, you have a charged polymer like DNA. It's inside the nanopore, and you apply an electric field, you measure currents, you want to understand what's going on. And we do this on the coarse grain level. The experiments from Kaiser who show some funny behavior, namely that if you stick a DNA in at a high salt condition, the current drops. If you stick it in at low current, at low salt conditions, the current rises. We want to understand that field. We are cross-graining the system, and we are worrying right now about different effects. Cross-graining system is easy. You just take beach spring model. Here it's a stiff rod because the DNA on this level is very stiff. You don't have to consider anything else. So you put charges in there. You put counter ions as explicit ions. You cross-grain the water away to a dielectric continuum of epsilon equals 80. We worry now about more or less three things, or two and a half. I mean, we have an implicit solvent model with a dielectric continuum. We want to make, or we have made actually, the effect of dielectric mismatch here, and look what happens. Namely, you have, of course, in a solid-state nanopore, the epsilon here is of the order 2 compared to 80. So we have to take that into account, which we can by applying a more sophisticated electrostatics algorithm. The second point we want to look at is we do classical MD, and we can also couple that to lattice Boltzmann, because we don't have any solvent right now there, but we can put it back via lattice Boltzmann coupling to see what the solvent effect, if hydrodynamics really plays a role maybe in putting in measuring these currents, because it's a nanopore, so therefore hydrodynamic effects could or could not be important. And if you do that, then you come actually into some subtle questions about the ion diffusivities in this nanopore, what are the correct boundary conditions at the wall. And so these are points we are currently worrying about. First, I can tell you the dielectric has an effect. Actually, if you look at translocation barriers in the free energy, you can get actually very large effects. This one is taking the effect into account. So you're at 12 kT, and if you don't do this, you are down at 4 kT. So it can actually make the barrier 3 times higher if you take a dielectric mismatch into account. I can also show you otherwise some pictures that it really doesn't matter so much if you go to higher salt conditions, because then you basically screen all these effects and it's very small. But now this was for a stiff rod. If you go to a flexible rod, then they increase again. Namely, if you have a flexible object, it has a higher chance of going close to the wall where these dielectric mismatch effects are highest, and therefore the barrier increases again. So long story, for stiff rods, low salt barrier is important. For flexible chains in the pore, they might be important all the time. This is basically the end. Right now we are worrying about how much atomistic details you actually have to put into your coarse-grain DNA system. So we make some comparisons of explicit DNA pieces in a rod, because I mean you have minor grooves. Question is now the friction of the ions when they pass by the DNA. Is that is it valid just to make a stiff rod with some generic friction, or do we really have to worry about the friction in the minor major grooves? So that is under investigation. I'm interested in that. If somebody has some ideas or is willing to discuss that with me, I'm happy. I'm still here till the 17th of April. I'm done. Thank you very much.